You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Alice Walker. We're here to talk about her new collection of essays, Anything We Love Can Be Saved, A Writer's Activism. I'm Michael Silverblatt. And my sense is that for you, an essay is something other than it is for other writers. That is to say, it strikes me, this collection, as being something like the blue ball you describe as having been inherited from your mother, that it brings back a memory of always being filled with good things and of good intentions, that the book desires not to so much impart information as to give feelings, impressions, to memorialize.
Well, it's, as you said earlier, it's about sharing the delights that one finds in discovering as you go along in life. I mean, discovery is just so exciting, and you find new things to discover all the time. For instance, that your hair is different from the way you thought it was. That's a major discovery to make.
When did you make that discovery?
Oh, I think, well along in my 20s and my 30s. We are, as people of color, really colonized in terms of our hair in many, all kinds of ways, but also in our hair, because we grow up having it straightened and having it, you know, sort of forced into different shapes. And, I mean, we're not alone in this, but it seems to me that it's particularly hard on us in terms of our consciousness.
I loved in the book, there's a photograph, and beneath it the caption says, "My dreaded family and friends." And at first, since I hadn't yet read the essay, I thought, dreaded?
I know. But you have to think of dreadlocks and the word dread in its archaic sense, which means to hold in awe, in respectful awe. And that is the way, it seems to me, that black people's hair is when it's in its natural state. It is awesome.
There seemed to be, throughout this book, a history of iconic and magical objects, the blue bowl, the alchemical table at Jung's house that later became the basis for the cover of which book?
Possessing the Secret of Joy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I wondered about those synchronicities that offer objects to you for inspiration.
Well, it's quite amazing how that happens. I just knew, in speaking of Jung, Carl Jung, I just knew that I needed to see that stone. I needed to see that stone that he had carved. And the carving itself represents transcendence, and there is a little person on it. There is a little homunculus on it. And in fact, what this little figure represents is the figure that you see of yourself when you look into someone else's eyes. And so when I was thinking about writing Possessing the Secret of Joy and writing about female genital mutilation, I thought about how if you do not have this whatever it is to present to someone, you can never see it in their eyes. I mean, they can never reflect back to you something that isn't there. And so when I got, we flew, my partner and I flew from Amsterdam to Zurich and then went on to Bollingen. And we got there, and I just had to touch it, to stroke it. And it gave me something. You know, it was as if Jung had really blessed this book that I was writing.
That visit was unheralded. That is to say, you arrived, you'd been told that many people have attempted to visit Bollingen, including the young woman who gave you directions there and had failed to get there. But for you, all the doors were mysteriously open. And you say in the collection as well, something that many writers have said to me, that writing precedes a manifestation,
mm-hmm.
that to write is to invoke in the manifested world the things that you write about. I wondered if you could speak about that kind of magic.
Well, when I was writing The Temple of My Familiar, the best example is that I was writing about our relationship to animals in the natural world. And just astonishingly, as I wrote, and more, the more that I wrote, the more animals appeared on my land in the country. I mean, even animals, even domesticated animals, broke away from their people and came to rest on my land. There were feral pigs who came, really, and you know. And then there were all just the regular animals, you know, but some of them that had not been there for you know, decades. I mean, there were hawks that hadn't been seen, and there were eagles that hadn't been seen, and there were, you know, always the snakes who lived there and who still are there. Rabbits and possums and raccoons, everything. And they were just really obvious. It wasn't as if, you know, that you know they're always there. Mm-hmm. Somewhere, mm-hmm. Some kind of animal. But, I mean, I would literally trip over them. I mean, they were just there in a way that was so magical that I started just speaking to them. You know, I started to just saying hello and, you know, how are you, and to the horses that you have to go back to where you came from. And so I felt very much that there was a connection between the animals who appeared and my desire to really connect with them in a very sincere and honest way, and to represent them in their wholeness rather than in fragments and as food.
It's very funny. There have been times in my life when I've felt, I will die if I do not see a chicken. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the feeling, and I remember the first time I saw a goat. I went to tell my grandmother, but my grandmother only knew goat in Yiddish, zig, and I had to describe what a goat was. Mm. And gradually her eyes lit, because in Russia there were goats, but she'd never heard the American word. And it astonished her. It widened her world that something existed.
And that you wanted to see one.
Yeah.
Oh, and did you get one?
I didn't get one, but I came to see their eyes.
Yes.
When you stare into the eyes of a goat.
And that's what I mean by get, in a way. I don't mean you know, just purchase it, but I mean, you know, just sort of, you know, have a goat in your environment somehow, or you go to visit.
Well, you understand the stigmatized animal, because this horned beast with its bar black eyes is imagined as the devil. Mm-hmm. This is the picture of the devil. Mm-hmm. And it looks at you with such peculiar lack of animosity, a genuine wisdom, mm-hmm. and willingness to let you look at it. Mm-hmm. You know, it did not break the gaze at all.
Right. Yep.
This collection, Anything We Love Can Be Saved, a very metaphysically powerful selection. That is to say, it emphasizes joy and acceptance over the bars to those things. And I wonder what you do with those blockades to joy.
Well, sometimes I sit with them for a number of years, and I've meditated, I mean, just in practical terms, I've meditated now for a couple of decades. And I have found that if I am able to go really deeply into myself and look at the parts of myself that I might not like very much, when I emerge, I can see those traits in other people and not need to throw things at them. This is very helpful.
You give the sense that once anger was more prevalent in your personality, and there is a very, what would you say, graceful willingness to say, if there are flaws in Fidel, I forgive them. If there are flaws, I know where they come from. The good must be emphasized. But where do you draw the line, or do you?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that on the way over, because I was thinking that really love itself is mysterious. Why do you love people? You know, why are you willing to love a person with all of their flaws? And, of course, this does not happen with everyone. You know, I mean, you would like it to. And there's this kind of generalized way a feeling that, you know, you don't hate anybody, but you certainly don't feel them passionately in your heart. But I was thinking how when I was a student studying Tolstoy, whom I, you know, adore, I had to deal with the fact that he was actually, you know, a slave owner, basically, and that he raped his serfs. I mean, he writes about this himself. And so, in a sense, this would be like Faulkner, you know, admitting all of these awful things, and then my living, you know, during the time when Faulkner actually lived himself. So it's very mysterious. I mean, you know, you could easily say that these people have done things that place them beyond your embrace in any way. I mean, you know, they're white, they're rich, they're men. And yet, this doesn't seem to be what happens. I mean, so I came to the conclusion, Michael, on the way over here, that basically love is inspired, that people inspire it, and it remains mysterious how they do it, why it works. But Fidel inspired me, especially in my youth. He inspired me because he put himself on the line for poor people. And I had never known a rich white man to do that.
Was he rich?
His father was very rich, and he was middle class. Now, his father started out very poor, but, you know, in that society, exploiting the people who cut the cane, you know, many of them people of color, he became very wealthy. So that Fidel had a very, you know, middle to upper middle class upbringing. But he put all of his energy, his considerable, you know, intelligence, his devotion on the side of the poor. I think this is really admirable. And this is why, you know, what flaws he's got, I accept them. And they just become a part of Fidel in the same way that Che, you know, had his flaws. And yet, you know, I think that he is a very modern Christ, Che Guevara. And then I think about people like Winnie Mandela, you know. I mean, Winnie may well have broken under the strain that she was placed under during all those years of, you know, just being squeezed by the South African government. But this does not mean that we should just discard or abandon her. You know, if she, as I say in this book, if she had broken her legs and couldn't walk, we'd understand. I mean, if they had broken them for her. But, you know, perhaps what is broken is her spirit. And so what we need to do is to really have empathy for that situation.
My guest is Alice Walker, and listeners know that she is the author, of course, of The Color Purple and The Temple of My Familiar, the book of poetry, Her Blue Body, Everything We Know, Possessing the Secret of Joy, the filmmaker who made the film with another filmmaker, Warrior Marx, and The Same River Twice. That was published by a small press, and I wanted to name it since it is a recent book.
Which book is that?
Honoring the Difficult.
Oh, The Same River Twice. It was actually published by Scribner.
Oh, that was published mm-hmm. by Scribner. But I saw a small book
you
of yours.
You saw Band.
Yes.
And that was actually not done by me, but by Pat Holt of the San Francisco Chronicle and Aunt Lute Books.
I see.
And they were doing that to stress how prevalent censorship is in this country, but also how much of my work has been censored and banned.
Now, you've spoken in one of these essays, in fact, of the question, will a set of characters arrive again? Will this be the last group that you are honored to entertain at your desk? Is there ever a point where you feel that they might not be repopulating?
Oh, yes. Yes, there are times when I feel that. And you know, hopefully I also then have a feeling that comes hard on the heels of that feeling, which is that, no, fine. You know, there are other things to do in the world.
Well, that's my sense. That one of the pleasures of looking through your list is that it's not just novels and books of poetry. It's occasional prose. It's journals. It's letters. It's seeing, in fact, that what a writer does is live in the world, not necessarily in one way,
right.
And that the writing activity is the off-screen activity and subordinate to the effects of the books in the world, I sense.
Well, I do feel that, you know, all of it goes together. I mean, I write, and I enjoy it very much. I do some kind of writing almost every day. But I have never felt that I was fixed in anything. And I have a feeling that if I'm ever fixed in any way, I mean, so that I'm just immobile as that, then I will be dead. It seems to me that you have to leave the possibility, even if, you know, if when it comes to something you really deeply love, you have to leave the possibility of walking away from it.
I'm speaking to Alice Walker on this day of KCRW's funding drive. This is a briefer show than usual, but I want to thank you very much for joining me today, Alice.
You're very welcome.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in the box.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.